My name is Mark Hollingsworth. I've been a journalist and author and historian for the past 40 years. And one of the main, the sort of the first main story that I wrote was for The Observer in 1985, and it was an investigation into how the BBC allowed an MI5. An intelligence officer inside Broadcasting House at Portland Place to vet people who were applying for jobs at the BBC. So this was a security vetting system set up in great secrecy inside the BBC, which started in the 1930s. And in essence, what happened was that the BBC secretly sent files and job applications from ordinary journalists, producers, everyone who applied for a job at the BBC. The file was sent to this intelligence officer, and he then sent the applications to MI5 headquarters. So this was done, as you would expect, in great secrecy. And this went on for many years, and quite a few journalists, producers, directors, employees were secretly blacklisted by the BBC or told that they their applications had failed and would not be employed. And in many cases, obviously, it was for genuine, legitimate reasons. They weren't good enough for the job or for some reason, but in many cases they were rejected because of their political views or their political activities, if they were a trade union activist or in any member of a radical political organization. If MI5 came back and said this person is a potential security risk, then the BBC would blacklist that individual. Anyway, the point is, I came across this story in early 1985, and I found various cases of people, the BBC had been blacklisted, and I published the article with two other journalists at The Observer in August 1985, and that was the basis for my book, Blacklist, which was published in 1988.
So it sounds as if this had been going on for a long time, but maybe have been the screws have been slightly tightened over the years, particularly maybe through the strike hit 1970s and into the 1980s.
Yeah, so it was set up in approximately 1935, and ostensibly the BBC would argue that, you know, certainly during the Second World War, that they had to vet applicants for jobs at the BBC for security reasons. You know, they could have been, during the Second World War, they could have been, you know, Nazis or you know, communists, or, you know, it could have been a genuine security threat. But they continued the secret vetting system after the Second World War. And as you say, it was at its height, I would say, during the Cold War, certainly in the 1970s, when when there were activists from the Socialist Workers' Party, Workers' Revolutionary Party, mainly on the left, but I think also on the right, where at that time there were many journalists and producers and directors and people who worked in drama and comedy who were political activists. And so the problem was that the BBC's vetting system is that the people who made the decisions, which was basically the intelligence officer, was a man called Brigadier Ronald Stonham, and he had a special room at Broadcasting House, room 105, inside Broadcasting House, and he sent files to MI5's head office, which was then mainly on Curzon Street in Mayfair. And the essence of the problem was that they could not understand the difference between someone who has radical political views and someone who's a genuine security risk. So their mistake or their prejudice was that if you had extreme political views, left or right, therefore you must be, you know, you're potentially a subversive and you're a danger to the security of the state. And so there's a fundamental intellectually ignorant understanding of how you know how political activists operate. And so
Now,
a lot of
this is
people
all supposed to be secret, Mark. How did you uncover this? I mean, it's quite an interesting one for a first story to have in the Observer.
So it was a kind of the system, the vetting system and the blacklist was kind of was known by many broadcasters and BBC, former BBC journalists, and it was sort of gossiped about. And the code for the system was called the Christmas tree. And the reason it was called the Christmas tree is that these files that were sent from Broadcasting House to MI5, they had a symbol on them of a Christmas tree for some reason. I don't quite know why. And so it was gossiped about. And one thing I can reveal, which I don't think I've ever published, is that the person who tipped me off and said you should look at MI5 blacklisting and vetting at the BBC was a man called Paul Greengrass, who's now a very famous film director. And Paul Greengrass was then working at Granada TV, and he'd heard about it from other people in the broadcasting world. And he was at Granada at the time, and then he said, "Look, you need to look into this." So I, and then he, as you may know, was also the ghostwriter for Peter Wright, who wrote Spycatcher. And anyway, so I started just really trying to talking to potential victims, and then once I found two or three victims who thought they'd been blacklisted, they gave me the names of their sort of boss, or their you know the senior producers or senior directors or editors of the programs they worked on. It was on Panorama, on various programs, and I then so it's a process of going from one person to the other, and then eventually I spoke to a BBC producer. And he said, "Well, the guy who's doing this is this weird military intelligence, a former military intelligence officer called Brigadier Ronald Stonham, and he has his office in Broadcasting House." So once I had that, and it was just painstaking, you know, trying to talk to as many people and piece it all together. And eventually, some of the bosses who had done the blacklisting had confirmed and admitted what happened.
So, did you ever meet the Brigadier?
I didn't, unfortunately. Although when the story was published, all the newspapers were chasing it, and they did find him, find his home address, and there's a great photograph of him walking out of his house in Surrey the day after the story was published. And he looked like the classic sort of English upper class or upper middle class, you know, army officer with his umbrella and you know very smartly dressed, sort of looking like a sort of character out of not really out of John le Carré, but more like sort of Evelyn Waugh or something out of a just very very English scene. And but unfortunately, no, I never met him.
Why does it matter?
Well, it matters because many people were blacklisted from employment and could not get employment, and they suffered because they just they couldn't get work. And you know it varied a lot. I mean, some were blacklisted and were you know unemployed. They if they were talented enough, they would obviously could get jobs at the ITV and Channel 4. But I think it matters because the whole security vetting process, which I then wrote about in my book Blacklist, it damaged people's lives because obviously they couldn't get employment, and so they suffered financially, and that you know created cr stress for their families. And but some of them also went to their grave. Not, I mean, there were cases where some people couldn't get jobs, and they were ne never quite sure whether they were blacklisted or not. So, there's a quite now quite a lot of archives have been opened up, but after the article was published, I know that a lot of the files were deliberately destroyed.
The Christmas tree seems obvious to me why they would use that as a symbol, which is the red flag, the tune of the red flag, surely.
Oh, of course. Yeah, exactly. So it's, I think the BBC is all obviously it's part of the state, and they would argue that what the BBC does, has to preserve, preserve and protect and defend the realm, but at the same time, it's supposed to be an independent journalistic organization. And so, when the story was published, they basically confirmed and admitted that it happened, but they claimed it was historical and that wasn't really happening in the 80s. But actually, it was going on right up until the early 80s. And then we published in 1985, and then they closed down the system. And unfortunately, quite a lot of the files were destroyed. But there is material in the archives if people are interested.
Now, the BBC is just one place where this has been going on. And I know, I think it was the Economic League was another organisation that was doing blacklisting, and it began its work, as far as I remember, in places like building sites. But the idea was really to destroy the careers of anybody who was a union activist. And we've seen this sort of thing even recently with people who are bringing up health and safety questions on building sites around the country also being blacklisted, and they won't employ them, a lot of the big builders. So, what about this Economic League? Am I right?
Yes, I mean, the Economic League was a privately funded, private or secret organization. It was set up just after the First World War when industry and businesses were very concerned about trade union activists, strikes, the popularity of the Communist Party at the time, and they were worried that industrial action and strikes and trade militant trade unionism would damage their profits and their business and create problems for them. So it was mainly in the building, as you say, in the construction industry, and it was sort of easier to sack people in the construction industry because it's sort of casualized form of employment. And so a lot of construction companies like Wimpey and Costain and Taylor Woodrow donated money to this organization, the Economic League. And they had a group of researchers, and they primarily what they did was to go through the newspapers, particularly the left-wing press, and cut out articles or any references to strikes or names of trade unionists, and compile files on individuals, basically trade union activists, pretty much. And so then what happened was that companies, if they, were checking, wanted to check new employees or applicants to join their company, they would send a list of names of the job applicants to the Economic League office, which is just off Fleet Street. And the researchers or the employees of the Economic League would go through their files and see if this individual was, an active trade union activist or radical left wing or right wing. And quite often they would call back the company personnel manager and say, this man was involved in a strike, or, he's dangerous, or he's going to be disruptive, or he's going to be risky for you to employ him. And on that basis, they companies often blacklisted or, did not employ people on that basis purely because they were radical, trade unionists. So it's not a security issue, it was more political and industrial. So the problem with the Economic League is that their sources of information were basically newspaper articles. And they had spies, they did have spies and sources, but it was primarily press cuttings. And this went on, for a long time until the Granada TV program World in Action exposed them and interviewed former personnel managers and exposed the unfairness and the discrimination and the blacklisting of people who were deprived of employment through no fault of their own. But again, it betrayed a misunderstanding of that you can be a have radical political views, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're a security threat or you're going to bring down a company. It just means you have radical views, and they just couldn't get to grips with that.
Well, I mean, I don't know if it even means you've got radical views. Most sensible workers, particularly in a casualised industry, might think it just makes sense to join a union, and they may bring up genuine issues of health and safety at work, which are actually putting workers' lives at risk.
Exactly, particularly in the construction industry. It's obviously risky, and they did it in engineering, electrical companies. I think it's mainly industrial manufacturing businesses. I wrote a separate book just on the Economic League, and it was ridiculous whereby some people, like even musicians who were, and a whole range of occupations, the Economic League will keep files on them. They seem to think that if you, as you say, there's nothing wrong with being a, obviously there's nothing wrong with being in a trade union. It's common sense. And you want to protect, you want to live in a, you want to work in a safe and fair environment. And also, if you feel secure in your job, you're going to do a better job, which is more profitable for the company that employs you. But I think, there was political prejudice, but I think it was ignorance as well. And I just think employers at that time, they just thought if you're a trade union activist, therefore that meant that you were more likely to encourage a strike. And if they go on strike, then that's bad for their business. So it was just partly political prejudice, partly ignorance, I would say.
So was the Economic League closed down? Because there's an interesting aspect to all of this. I mean, you quite rightly point out this is unfair, but it may be perfectly legal.
It was, I think it was legal. In recent years, the TUC, and they tried to sue the Economic League, but Economic League no longer exists. It was closed down. I mean, my book came out in 1988, and then I did a book, Blacklist, and then another book just on the Economic League. That was like 1990, I think. And it carried on for a few years in the 90s, but then I think it closed down largely because the funding stopped, because trade union militancy and activity really stopped pretty much in the 1990s. It's difficult to think, maybe with the train drivers, but it's difficult to think of a major strike after the Wapping dispute in 1986, 87. There weren't some major strikes, and obviously unions exist. The train drivers have certainly been very militant, but I think when we exposed it, I think employers realized that the Economic League and to do this was unfair, but also just not very smart, and they just understood that it was the wrong way to do it.
Well, I mean, you're sort of suggesting here that you've shamed them into submission, but I do wonder with the computer age. I mean, it might be that something like this exists and people don't know about it, and that you can just destroy someone's career at the press of a button.
Well, I think that's true. I don't know is the answer, but I think that obviously the capacity for collecting data on people is infinitely more extensive and cheaper and easier and cost efficient, and so the potential, the capacity of corporations to collect data on individuals and store them in files is much. It's much easier, and I'm sure it goes on. I don't have any proof of it, but I think also, but then on the other hand, trade unions are far less powerful than they used to be. In the 1960s and 70s, they were virtually an arm of government, certainly when Labour was in power. Thatcher obviously tried to, and did to a large extent, suppress the unions in the 80s. And so I'm not sure if the big tech companies are employing files on troublesome employees. Everything seems to be casualized these days, so I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if they do keep files on individuals, but I'm not sure. I think it's different from what the BBC did and what MI5 did and the Economic League and all these blacklisting organizations. I think that if they do it now, it's probably for different reasons, but I'm speculating.
Well, yeah, I mean, any big organization, it may well be that the people running it want a whole bunch of people working for them that are of a similar mindset. And you know what this just reminds me of up in the modern world is the Chinese social credit system. The idea that if you're doing something which upsets the state or upsets President Xi, that your rating goes down. So, I mean, this brings up really, I suppose, the whole idea, which is being pioneered by the Chinese at the moment, of profiling all of your citizens and categorizing everybody.
No, I think there's a similarity there, or basically the surveillance state and the notion that the state is, the classical Orwellian concept that the state is all powerful. And I think actually with technology and the power and the capability, certainly in China, but virtually every country, to retain data on people gives the state huge power. And so, but whether they are using that power to blacklist individuals is quite possible. I mean, I can see, I'm speculating, that the big tech barons, Musk, Zuckerberg, Bezos, I mean, who knows? Maybe they are keeping files on individuals, and it's quite, with technology, it's relatively easy to do. But I'm not sure if they are, in the because there's no culture of radicalism or trade unionism or militancy within the big tech companies. So it could be, I don't know, I'm speculating. But I think it's a different culture from the Cold War, obviously, and different technologically.
Well, Sam Altman's OpenAI recently had a whistleblower in California that a couple of weeks after he blew the whistle, he had loads of documents that they were deliberately stealing people's copyright and feeding it into the AI to train it. And he ended up dead. Tucker Carlson interviewed his mum. And now, I mean, this may be part of the business model. Who knows? And you're right, a lot of this is speculation. And of course, we're living in a much more, I think, corporate world, which is much more difficult for journalists to penetrate than things were in the 1970s when you did your work on blacklisting and got the book out. Anyway, Mark, can you just give us a few of a list of some of the books? People are interested in reading up on this. I know it's quite ancient history in a way, but I know you've been writing other books, more recent ones as well.
Well, the Blacklist book came out in 1988. You may or may not be able to get it on Amazon. And then the follow-up sequel to that was called The Silent McCarthyism, which was a shorter book just on the Economic League. And that came out in 1989. And then I moved on to write a book about Mark Thatcher and the Thatcher family in the 1990s. And then I broke a big story about a former MI5 officer called David Shaler. And so I wrote a book about MI5 called Defending the Realm, and then moved on to the Saudi royal family and other books. And then perhaps your listeners be most interested in my most recent books were a book about the Russian oligarchs in the UK. That was called Londongrad. And then my most recent book is called Agents of Influence, which is about KGB, the covert operations in the UK and the USA. And so I often specialize in writing about the intelligence world, but I've also done a lot of work on Russia and the Middle East and political corruption.
You mentioned David Shaler. I must comment on the fact that he then decided that he was Jesus, and also that he was actually a woman, and so he was a transvestite, kind of jumping around. I wondered, you're trying to write a series, a book about him, but I mean, in a way, he's kind of discredited himself and you, hasn't he?
No, well, when the book came, when we published the articles and when the book came out, and then probably at least 5 years after that, he was very serious, straight shooting, measured, and everything that we wrote, the government did not deny. The one big dispute was his claim that MI6 had a plot to assassinate Gaddafi in 1996, and that was quite well documented. I mean, the government denied it, but you would expect them to. But my point is, they were not able to discredit him in the period when we first published the stories in 1997. The book came out in 1999, and we carried on publishing material based on Shaler and also his girlfriend, Annie Macken, who was also an MI5 officer, former MI5 officer. So she corroborated a lot of what he was saying. And then I'm not sure exactly when, but I think soon after 9/11, he then, when he was no longer really getting so much attention, perhaps I'm speculating why he then became very eccentric, became a lot, got into a lot of conspiracy theories, particularly on night about 9/11. And gradually he became more and more eccentric, and I lost touch with him. And as you say, he then dressed as a woman, and then he claimed that he was Jesus. But my point is, at the time of publication, in terms of what we published, it was never discredited, and his unfortunate decline into, what you've described happened at least, at the very least, 10, 15 years after we first published.
Okay, Mark Hollingsworth, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you, Tony.